Welcome to the Humans and AI Podcast, powered by AI Frontier Network. I'm your host, Flor Laorga. Each episode, we dive into the human story shaping artificial intelligence through the journeys of entrepreneurs, builders, and leaders. We explore the insights, challenges, and visions for the future of AI and humanity. Let's uncover the human side of AI together. So, Greyjoy, very nice to meet you. Thank you very much for joining the Humans and AI podcast, and I appreciate you make time for this. I know that we are all very busy right now. So thank you very much. I'm very excited to learn a little bit more about you. Let's dive into it. I know you are the CEO of Gian, but before going into that part of what right now you are doing, I would like to go back to the beginning. So what first drew you to the intersection of technology and business?
All right. Very happy to be here, Flor. That's a big rewind. Okay, but let's start. So I think when I was in college, I convinced my uncle, who ran a small manufacturing business, that he really needed to automate his bookkeeping and accounts payable, and that I was the guy who could do it. And this was a bit of an overreach on my part. At that point, I didn't know accounting, and I was a novice at programming. But he said yes. We tried to build something. It didn't work, but he let me down very gently, with no permanent damage to his business or my ego. To answer your question, that was where I saw that there was something missing from a technology standpoint to solve his business problem. And of course, I didn't have the tools. I didn't have all the opportunity to learn prior to that. I was an electronics and electrical engineer. So this was a little bit distant from me. That was sort of my first introduction. But after that, just very quickly, I joined Hewlett-Packard in India. And in those days, the IT function, the software function always was under this, buried, I would say, under the CFO. It was a back office function. It was seen as a cost center. So you didn't really get the opportunity to learn that much about the whole world of business, but you did learn a lot about the world of process, right? And that actually has stayed with me, that at enterprise scale, people have to align with and follow a certain set of processes. We don't and can't afford to have too many mavericks. That has carried through, and you will see that in the rest of this conversation. But what really flipped on a switch for me was, so one day I get a call from the vice president of supply chain in Ireland, in Hewlett-Packard, say, do you want to come to a project for me? And it was a global project across 6 countries. And suddenly he was giving me 40 people in my team. Before that, I had 2 or 3. And a budget of $4 million. Before that, my budget was $100K max. And that kind of trust and faith, and I was undercooked for sure, right, at that point. And for him to take that kind of a chance on me, and hopefully I didn't let him down, he must have seen something, I don't know what. And that was the flip for me. And then it became clear that technology is really an enabler for business. We are not just some back office function. Okay.
It was a great answer. Wow, that's so interesting. I think that in every founder's journey, someone believed in you, right? Someone believed in you and said, okay, you have something, you can do it. I think that's the most important part. When was a moment or a mentor who helped you to start with not just technology, that we already, you talked about a few people already, but about AI, to use AI?
Okay, so my connection with AI actually happened a lot later. But you could argue in those early days, the definition of AI was whatever technology couldn't do today was called AI. Okay. And then it evolved and evolved. And then after I became an entrepreneur, I worked with Hewlett-Packard, American Express, have some big company experience. After I became an entrepreneur in the first company, you know, a startup, I was the COO. It was a startup that was already well in progress. Our founder was the person who introduced me to all this. It was a chance meeting a breakfast meeting in New Delhi, and suddenly I'm working in his company 1 month later. So that was my first foray into the world of AI, and it was AI in the context of an enterprise. Okay, so it was not end user AI. This is AI for the enterprise, for business. Then you need to begin at a different place. You can't hallucinate, you can't make things up, you can't change your answer, you can't infringe on somebody's IP. Those things were baked in. So it happened gradually, Flor. It wasn't like one big moment. I think it was more organic. And then suddenly I'm running this as CEO, this language model company called Gian. So I mean, I jumped over a lot of stuff in between, but that's the big picture.
Beautiful story. Talking a little bit about you, you've met teams across Asia, Europe, and the US. So how have these cultural experiences shaped the way that you live today as the CEO of GAM?
So firstly, I was very lucky to live in very exciting places. Ireland, Hong Kong, Singapore, India, Puerto Rico, of course, the United States. And I've done 7 international relocations with a family and 2 beagles, 2 untrained dogs. Spoiler alert, moving doesn't get easier with practice. No matter how many times you move, it's equally hard. I think that was my biggest lesson. But this living like a nomad like this, right? I think just to try to bring home the point, I think there's an interesting upside. Okay, you could argue which is the better life. Do you stay in one place? I've been like moving around really like a nomad in the course of my career on more and more senior opportunities. It had to keep me on my toes. Everything was constantly new. New culture, new social environment, new workplace, different business areas, new challenges. So it helps you build this, I would call it, I don't know, rapid adaptation, a new muscle, a rapid adaptation muscle, or another muscle called a resilience muscle. So it just, you have to have that, otherwise you won't survive this. That doesn't mean other people's careers have to be, you don't have to do all this to develop those muscles, but you have to be able to say yes more often than say no. Okay, some of the things that I think I learned, but I think the key context is basically what works in one place may not work in the other. What worked before may not work the next time. So you really, every situation is new. You have to adapt, and I think you have to lead with empathy and listen and understand first. This is a big topic, but 2-3 quick things if I may. Change management was always super important in all the projects that I did, programs, because we're introducing technology and disrupting something. Now, there I found a stark contrast in how you do it, let's say in a Singapore versus in the US. One culture is a little bit more hierarchical, more top-down, where instructions from the boss will percolate. And the other, you have to do a lot more onboarding, a lot more getting people to accept the change. That's one difference. Another difference that I found was when I was in Hewlett Packard and they acquired Compaq. So both these countries were multinational. They came together. And it was very interesting that Hewlett Packard's decision-making style was infamous in the Bay Area at that time. It was a slow, consensus-driven process. Everybody had to say yes. And one person says no, the decision is gone. And Compaq was rapid, super quick. One guy decides, it goes through. When these two companies came together, that was a huge point of contention. In the end, it turned out that in the HP model, there was less disruption. The decisions took more time, but they were better. Okay? And so I found those two things quite interesting to just quickly highlight. And of course, there are so many other minor points. Like in the US, people are very hung up on how you pronounce their name. In the Asian countries, nobody cares. So you pick these things up, you adapt, you listen, you learn, and then you do the best you can.
Thank you. That's actually very wise words. Thank you. I cannot get you about the names because it's kind of happens to me sometimes that I'm not a native English speaker. I've learned to ask how do you pronounce their names before, because people can get very, you don't even know what is my name.
Yes.
Like, for example, my name, like you were very kind to ask me in the beginning before we start recording. My name is actually, you say it very well, but most of the native English speakers, they're not able to say right my name. But I don't say anything because I understand. It's just, it's not personal.
And something that you have also experienced.
So talking a little bit about your company, Jan, that's, you do a lot about eliminating hallucinations in AI, right? As well today, hallucinations is also a hot topic today, but what's the danger of eliminating hallucinations?
Okay, the danger of hallucination, we know that it might take us to a place where we don't want to go and make it look very believable. Danger of not hallucinating. Okay, so I think, okay, then maybe a flip way to ask, where is hallucination good? Okay, maybe that's a way to start. Hallucination, I think, is you want it. You want hallucination. Okay, what is this generative AI? Gyan is a slightly different architecture from the generative AI. So I'll be constantly contrasting these two, okay? So generative AI or LLMs like ChatGPT or Grok or Claude or whatever, simply, to put it simply, and you know all this, but just to reiterate, it's a recombination machine. It recombines, it has ingested every written word that's on the internet. It has trained itself. And you ask a question and it gives you an answer, which obviously has to come from there. It can't come from outside, right? So it's the interesting recombinations based on all kinds of algorithms. If you're looking for something creative, if you're staring at a blank page and you want ideas on, I don't know, how to write something, or if you're looking for a new material, because material science is becoming so important in the context of climate change and sustainability, or if you're looking for a new drug in pharma, or anything new that you're trying to discover that is too hard for us to recombine and make, the machine will do a far better job. Okay. So I think that's where you want the hallucination to be turned on, I would offer or suggest. But if you eliminate hallucination, then you've reached the zone of safe AI. So you've come right around and suddenly your AI is safe and all problems are solved and nobody's got any issues with generative AI anymore. So I would say elimination of AI is the hallucination is the same as making AI safe again. Okay, this is, I was just thinking about it before our discussion here, that when the 2026 elections come up for the House and all of that, we are going to be flooded with fake videos, fake audio, fake articles, all either hallucinated or deliberately made by bad actors. Right now, when you know that 10% of all content is fake, you might be lulled into thinking everything is generally still okay. When 50% of the content is potentially fake, I think you will be forced to think. At that point, we will have to assume that what I'm reading is not correct, may not be correct. And I think it might do something interesting to the way we approach information. And it might wake us up all over again. And that could be a nice unintended side effect. Then we really have to figure it out for ourselves. That'll be an interesting turning point.
Okay. So I think, I believe there's a lot of fake things going on already. Always in media and things, there's always things that was always a bit turning, twist the whole context, right? It's not always, it's not the real thing. But do you think what happened? You already said that we will have to think more.
Yeah.
For example, you focus on making AI and trustworthy collaborator in sectors like finance, legal, and healthcare. That's the sectors that you focus the most on. Yeah. What does collaboration between humans and AI looks like in practice for you?
Okay, so I have not yet fully described the difference between Gyan and other generative AI, maybe at some point soon. But you might have heard this term like human in the loop. Okay, when you're doing this, AI is okay because there's a human in the loop. In Gyan, although we haven't used this phrase too much, but it is human at the center. Okay. So basically, when you're using Gyan, you are in control of the whole experience. Gyan is not an autonomous engine that can go out of control. Okay. You are the driver. You have the steering wheel in your hands. It's not a self-drive car in that sense. So you control the sources. So let's say I want to find out, I don't know, whatever your query is. You say, get the answer from these sources. Ignore those sources. Show me how you arrived at this answer. Show me a link from this sentence in your answer all the way to the source document and why you picked it. So that level of transparency, auditability is required in these verticals that you just mentioned where the cost of a mistake is high, where you can't afford, when you're audited, you have to be able to provide explanations. You can't say, I don't know, the AI told me. So I think something like Gyan that is explainable, grounded, and doesn't run off and do things on its own, unless you ask it to, some autonomous behavior you can invoke, that I think makes it the ideal sort of assistant for people working in these fields. Pharma, legal for sure, even publishing, higher education, many corporations too. Even many corporations will want that explainability. For example, we are talking to and working with some financial services firms. They need to be able to explain why your home loan application was refused. You can't just say it was refused and full stop. So that's with a clear explanation and a clear trace to the source documents. That's the big difference.
Before we were talking a little bit about how difficult it would be to know what is real and what is not, how do you think that like ordinary people who are not like experts in AI and experts in the technology and knowing that they can hallucinate or say fake things. So how is the ordinary people to tell the difference between what's hype and what is backed up by delivery and promises? Like, how can they figure out?
That's a deep question, because when you type something into Gyan or you type a query into ChatGPT, in both cases, you'll get an answer. Okay, and here I'm telling you that the Gyan one is not hallucinating and it's all grounded and all that, and the other one, we don't know for a fact. We don't know every time whether it's introduced some new words or made some facts up. So I think in both cases, you'll get an answer. In the Gyan case, it is up to the user to verify whether that is true or not, okay? Until you reach the point where you just trust Gyan by default. Okay, until then, you have to ask Gyan, show me, why are you saying that climate change is causing coral reef damage in Western Australia? Show me the research. Show me where you got this from, how you came up with this analysis, and why you're presenting me this. So you can verify the Gyan output by double-clicking and double-clicking until you get to the source. You have to accept that. And you can, of course, get a document that is linked saying, the answer came from this document, but you won't quite know which part of the document and whether it is mixed up with content from other documents. Okay, so I think the onus is still on the user. And to the point where they develop trust with a specific company or specific type of AI, then they don't have to verify every time.
Okay. No?
Does that make sense?
No, because for me, it was kind of understanding if there would be like, I know that with Gyan, it's kind of, you guys are building something that's avoiding these kind of fake, these things to go things wrong. So if there's a process that you think that you guys would apply to avoid that, also for the users, from someone external, you know what I mean? How they will understand if they don't verify or not, like what they have been searching or they are typing or looking into Gyan. Because I feel, for example, myself, when I use ChatGPT, which I use it constantly all the time, that things that I really trust 100%. But that things that I know that I that's wrong, and I said that, okay, please just change that. But so when it's them between those two things, like, how do I know 100% what I'm typing, for example, in ChatGPT, that it's real? Because I don't have the time, for example, myself to look up everywhere and check Claude, check Anthropic, check, and then Google. I don't have the bandwidth to do that. So that was my question as well, a little bit that way.
Okay. So like I said, once you develop LLMs are pre-trained, right? They're pre-trained on every word that humans have put on the internet. Okay. And from that, they've derived a language model, and the language model and the data are all mixed up. So when you ask it a question, it is going to answer from its pre-trained data set, or you are aware of the deep research function, right? Or you can do deep research and it'll go to live web sources, but it'll also use the pre-trained data set to commingle the data. In Gyan, Gyan is a blank slate. It has nothing. Okay, it's just the language model. It's blank. You tell it where to go. You say, look at only my corporation's data. Look at only these 5 sources on the internet. Ignore these 10 sources at all the time. Don't look at blog sites, because blog sites contain a lot of personal opinions and I'm not interested. So you control the sourcing for Gyan. That is one big difference. So at least you know where it came from. Okay. We also have a lot of evidence. For example, there's 2 benchmarks that we have published in the pharma world. We are scoring at the top of the leaderboard, ahead of GPTs and the Anthropics and anybody else who has participated in that leaderboard. So that should give the user confidence that the answer is correct. So 2 parts. One is, where are you getting the answer from? So that, I said, the user controls that. And is the answer correct? So these benchmarks serve as the proof that Gyan's accuracies, at least in these two examples better than all the others. People have to use it. They have to know how it's working. And Gyan will never introduce something that's not in the documents that you have picked. You can point it to USPTO, to PubMed, to other major public sources or private sources. The trust has to be built, but you have to know the architecture, that it is only from your chosen sources.
Okay, thank you very much for clarifying that part. Also, I hear that you say a lot that the future of AI depends on trust more than capability, right? So moving on to mostly the, let's say, human side of AI, who is doing work you admire right now in AI? Who is doing the work that you admire right now in AI?
Whose work I admire?
Yeah. Do you admire some of them?
Because see, the thing is, we started our whole company on the basis of explainability, right? And groundedness and controlled sourcing and all of that, right? So I have this, and we believe that if you start from the other side, which is use a lot of data to train your language model, then you are already starting in the wrong place. You're starting with a black box. So my bias always will be to appreciate people who are on, who've started like us in our side, right? Or those who believe in safe AI. So in the LLM world, I see that Anthropic has basically made some big statements about their commitment to safety and trust, et cetera. In terms of individuals, in terms of companies, our own company, Gyan, okay, obviously we admire it, we are here. Our founder, Venkat Srinivasan, he is also a leading thinker, and actually he's the chief scientist for Gyan as well, on AI in general, and this, our brand of AI. So I think if you want people who are challenging the mainstream architecture and not just climbing on the bandwagon, I think we appreciate those people because they're questioning. We are saying we have an alternative architecture that does AI differently, but we are small. Okay, it takes time. We have to work company by company until we build some scale. And we have some very interesting customers, by the way. Our customers are open to challenging the generative AI architecture. Those are friends.
Great. Do you have any examples of those?
Individuals, yeah. I can, like all the employees in our company, I can name our founder, who I have, Venkat Srinivas, and others who are biased towards trust. See, the search company, Mozilla, you've heard of Mozilla. So they're basically grounded on trust. And then there are other larger companies, but individuals, I just named those two people.
Thanks. So talking more, a little bit more about leadership, what are the two personal values that you have consistently guided through your leadership?
Okay. That's a difficult question because you need me to distill it to two. I can give you a long list. But I think throughout, what is always possible, I think, to distill it to at least the top few. I would say first and foremost, it is whatever I do or build or small or large teams that I've been leading. Early on in my career, I had enough guidance to now continue with that guidance and make it people first. It is all about the people. Okay, so instead of building a product-first organization or AI-first organization or a customer-first organization, what I would propose is like we all build people-first organization. Everything flows from that. And then some sub-bullets under that would be assume the best in the people, not the worst. Play to their strength. Forget about their weakness, right? Trust people right away. Blank check of trust, right, to a new employee. And then, of course, when you do that, once in a while, that trust will be broken. But don't change. Continue to do that because somebody took a chance in my own career. I could have let him down really badly and very visibly. It would have impacted his career. In the end, things turned out okay. And I would say on the people side, we have to lead with empathy. That means we have to see the world from the other person's shoe at all times, whether it's a customer, whether it's a spouse, whether it's an employee, whether it's a partner, whether it's whatever, right? I think that is, so it's all very people-centric. The second thing I would highlight, Flor, here is that I was just thinking about it before this call, because I could make a long list, but it's the non-verbal communication, right? In a leader, what you don't say is as important as what you say. When you choose to speak, when you choose to stay silent. So I think in the non-verbal part, at least in a startup, any company actually, energy. The leader has to bring energy. Energy is often in short supply. You have to bring that energy and then you have to infect everybody with that energy. Okay, that's how you keep this machine going. You have to bring optimism, then infect everybody with that optimism, even when things are not looking good, because things are not always good. And then one other word I'd add is buoyancy, like this tendency to keep floating up to the top, right? So one must have some level of buoyancy and not be defeated, right, by anything, or as a leader, at least you can't show it that much. So those are some of the things I'd say. So people and the non-verbal side of who you are.
I love that. Good. I've asked these questions to many people before, but nobody told me about non-verbal communication. And I think it's very important. And also the energy that you bring and be positive to your team and things like that's very good. Thank you. I really like that because I haven't heard often the non-verbal thing, but it's actually very, I was kind of, when you're talking, I was like, that's for me, I agree with that 100%.
Yeah, because if they even say, I don't know how well researched it is, but in some of the HR and communication research, you'll see that 70 to 80% of all communications is not words, non-verbal. Whatever that means, I've never like gone and checked those research things, but I think it's pretty obvious in my own life.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. Not only in business, but also in everyone's life, I think. I agree. It's also about awareness. Okay, I've got one last question for you, and it's a bit about legacy. I'm not sure if you have thought about it yet, because, yeah, I think that you still have a lot of journey to live, but anyways, so if you ever thought about your legacy, not just in tech, but as well as you're also a human-centered person, what impact do you hope to leave behind?
Okay. Look, you made it the last question. So firstly, legacy, I haven't had thought too much, but I have some philosophical thinkings about it. I think my present action is much more important than my legacy. So I don't worry about that too much. And I don't know how many people have time, but I'd say that. So I am actually a closet, or maybe not even closet, mildly active, but very passionate, sustainability and climate enthusiast. And I see the convergence of AI and those things and how that might be the silver bullet, right? Because there seems to be no silver bullet to solve that problem. AI for all problems and challenges and all of that, that could be something there. But anyhow, you said personal and technical, right? So in the technical world, I feel that we are doing the right thing. We have taken the difficult but the correct road in Gyan and try to stay grounded and explainable and not create more confusion in this already confused setup and give people a reliable, trustworthy way to get more efficient. So I think on the AI side, we are doing what we would like to do. On the other side, the bigger side of this leave the place better than you found it kind of thing that people tell us, and which is the right thing as well. So we have created this whole trifecta, right, of crisis. Obviously, this whole environmental thing, social unraveling. And then this funny thing is we are on this AI bandwagon without an end game. We're just going. No regulation, no nothing, just ride. So those are three things. Maybe they can be used in a way that makes each and every one of those things better. So I would say, along with this AI, I would like to, if I get the chance and the opportunity, to really bring whatever I can to the world of corporate sustainability. Whatever I know about climate science, which is not much at all, and all the things I've learned about entrepreneurship and working in a big company process, blah, blah, blah. I think there's a need. I think there's room for action there. But of course, none of this is figured out since you asked.
Thanks very much, Joy. I have a great interview and great conversation. I found it very wise, your words, honestly. Really like it. It's very kind of the way also I think. So I guess that all being living in different cultures and living countries, this can affect a lot and influence the way we think.
Lovely to talk to you also, Flor.
Thanks for listening to the Humans and AI podcast. We are here to spotlight the people making AI more human, one story at a time. See you in the next episode.